My guest today is Tanya Pinkins, a Tony Award-winning actress singer who has starred in 9 Broadway shows, including the original Carolina Change. Now, she has won or been nominated for nearly every award there is in American theater, and she is also a Fulbright specialist. Now, in addition to being an actress and an author, Tanya is a playwright, a director, and educator. She even wrote the essay, Why I Am Fed Up with Performative Activism from Black and White Theater Makers, has been made required reading at universities, including Yale School of Drama. She has starred in 245 episodes of the soap opera All My Children, also starred in 24 with Kiefer Sutherland, as well as Gotham, Scandal, Fear the Walking Dead, and Madam Secretary. Now, she played Alma Carthen, Emmett Till's grandmother, in ABC Hulu's Women of the Movement. And she now plays Mrs. Marie Willis on the hit show Sisters, which you can actually catch right now on BET. But her award-winning film, Red Pill, from 2021, has now been translated into Spanish, Catalonian, even Russian and Greek. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome multi-talented, Tony Award-winning actor, singer, director, and playwright, and author, Tanya Pinkins, to the show. Welcome, Tanya.
Thank you, Ward. Thank you. I learned some things myself from that intro.
Well, I would say you are an experienced, seasoned actress and more. So you have quite the impressive resume, but I have to ask you, did you find acting or did acting find you?
Hard to say. I think that my mom noticed that I spent a lot of time alone and that you couldn't punish me by telling me I couldn't go outside because I could just play alone in my room with I don't know if you remember the Sears wish book. I could play with the Sears wish book. I could imagine every toy in there. So she got me, doing little community theater classes from the time I was about 9 years old.
Wow. It's funny you bring up the Sears Wish book because I forgot all about it. But yeah, I was like you. You thumb through there and just wishing and maybe even mark the pages, hoping that one of those toys would just jump out and you would have it. But big dream book.
Yes, it was. It was. I would play with everything in my mind.
That is so good. So you started doing some theater around the age of 9. Now, did you end up in any professional theater training academies?
I did. So, there was a woman named Frances Moore. She had an academy, and I took voice lessons with her. And then I did plays in my elementary school. And my elementary school teacher, the elementary school teachers teach everything. He was a hobbyist actor. And he was studying at a place called the St. Nicholas Theater Company, which was started by Greg Mosier, David Mamet, Stephen Schachter, and William H. Macy, who we knew as Bill Macy. And so he lobbied really hard for me to go into their acting program as a 15-year-old. So I was the only young person in an acting program where John Mahoney was taking his first acting class at 45. I was 15, and we were in acting class together with Bill Macy.
My goodness. Now, was it intimidating in the beginning?
No. There was something about the Meisner method that I just naturally got, even when I did it with young people. So I think that they saw that from me in the young people's program, and they felt, yes, I was ready to do this work with adults.
Wow, that is very impressive. So when did your career on Broadway start?
19. I got my first Broadway show over Christmas break of my freshman year at college at Carnegie Mellon. My same elementary school teacher said he'd read about a open call, like a cattle call in the Chicago Sun-Times or Tribune. And I was on my way to Puerto Rico for the Christmas break. And he was like, you should skip Puerto Rico. Come do this cattle call for Joanna Merlin, actress, casting director, who just recently walked on. And I was like, what, a cattle call? But I did. And at the end of the audition, Joanna said, I'd like to take you to New York over the holiday to audition for Hal Prince and Stephen Sondheim. And I did, and they said, "We would like to invite you to be in Merrily We Roll Along on Broadway," which wasn't going to happen till next fall. So I got to finish my freshman year, and we started rehearsing the summer of 1981 in New York.
Well, were you always a confident kid?
I don't think so. I think I was pretty shy, but I will say that I always marched to the beat of my own drum. So I feel like I was always such an outsider that I was comfortable being an outsider. So if someone was ostracizing me, I'm like, okay, I'm used a bit to that.
Well, for you, when you started auditioning for different things at such a young age, what was that like for you, and how did you handle if you didn't get a part?
I think it's that same sort of ostracization kind of thing. Like growing up on the South Side of Chicago, I was growing up at a time where they were just starting to integrate neighborhoods. So the area that I first moved in had been called Pill Hill. I was in a Pill Hill adjacent neighborhood. So it had been a very predominantly Caucasian doctor neighborhood, and then the adjacent people. Well, as they have started allowing black people to move in, all of those people moved out. So my school was a magnet school, and so it had to be racially, economically balanced. So when I moved into that neighborhood, there was a balance, but by the time I kept growing up, they started having to bus white kids into that school. But it meant I always grew up in a school that was very diverse, ethnically, financially, racially, culturally. That's the way I grew up in school. But in my neighborhood, which had just turned to being like an all-black neighborhood, I was thought of as being conceited, or maybe I thought I was better than them because my mother put me in class from the time I was like 3 years old to learn how to walk right with books on my head and how to talk with marbles in my mouth. So I talked too proper, and my mother would go get my hair done. And so in my neighborhood, they kind of always wanted to beat me up, but I fit in this magnet school where there was just a lot of diversity. So I was used to being the outsider. And so I think that that can manifest as confidence because I just got comfortable being ostracized.
You know, the thing that I've been trying to grapple with, I had an interview probably about a year ago or so with actress Tajra V. Simpson, who is on Tyler Perry's The Oval. And she grew up in Lake Charles, Louisiana, and she was telling me a story on how she was dealing with, I guess you would call it, internal racism from her own neighborhood. I found that interesting, but I was intrigued, but I didn't really get it. And you seem to have put up with the same thing.
Yeah, it was like the black kids thought, well, you talk like that, you talk like a white person, you must think you're better than we are. So there was a lot of people trying to fight me about that.
So what is your opinion on that? Because I know that even Tyler Perry has had to put up with that when he was growing up.
I think that that's something that society sort of cultivates in a sort of divide and conquer kind of way to try to create this sort of division between people. I think it happens a lot to young people when you're really smart and you like to read books. It's like, oh, you're going to go to college, so you think you're better than us. So I think that that's that, just that sort of, crabs in a barrel kind of thing.
Yeah, I got you. Did your background, growing up in the neighborhoods, the school systems, did that help shape you in some of the roles that you have played?
Absolutely. I grew up with five generations under one house, under one roof. I knew my grandmother's grandmother on both sides of my family. And so I think that my connection to family and history and seeing births and deaths in my home has given me a really broad understanding of life that many people don't have today. There's so many people today who've never seen a birth or a death, who've never held an infant before. So it's just allowed me to have an authentic empathy for a wide range of characters. I know when I played Anita in Jelly's Last Jam, there was a womanliness about her that I had recognized in the women in my family, but I'd never been offered the opportunity to play that. And it was something I really wanted to try to bring to life in that character.
You know, one of the things I've learned from very experienced actors like yourself, you know, acting coaches like Stella Adler, Lee Strasberg, you know, they always emphasized live life, educate yourself with your surroundings, learn, because everything that you, well, soak in like a sponge, you're going to be able to use one day in a particular role.
Absolutely. And I studied with Stella. That's, I feel like I'm constantly trying to learn and educate and go and sit and listen to people, because there is nothing that I take in that is, can't be part of a role. I now say that anything that a human is capable of, I want to give myself permission to be capable of. Like, there's nothing that I can say, I couldn't be that. No, I could be anything.
Amen to that. I completely agree. Well, from you, so you have had a very successful career on Broadway. How did you transition from Broadway into television?
Interestingly, at the time that I was coming up in the 80s, there were these very strict dividing lines between actors and television actors and theater actors and musical theater actors. So like now anybody can do anything and you get to see the range of talent that people have. But at the time that I was coming up, actors didn't sing. So I would literally have to go, okay, I want to be in that straight dramatic thing. I'd have to change my hair and look, you know, there was a certain kind of look that a straight actor had, and I'd have to, you know, become a new character to go and audition for this straight role. And then I'd get it. And then people would forget that I knew how to sing. And then, you know, musical theater actors, that was a look. So then I'd have to go get some new headshots and go in and be that. And it would, for a very long time, there was this thing of like, people would forget that I had done this other thing because now I was doing this thing.
it really intrigues me with actors who know how to sing. There are so many well-known actors that do know how to sing, but we never hear them do it because it's never required in any of the roles that they are called to do. And so, I mean, my gosh, even at the Oscars, I mean, when Ryan Gosling just sang the short little Barbie thing, who knew that he could actually pull that off? Or Emma Stone does that, and so many others. There, I think it's just, sometimes I wonder, how in a world does an actor, or maybe the directors or the casting agents, can't they pull more out?
Well, you know, here's an interesting thing that two casting directors said to me one day, and it was kind of disturbing. They said, you know, Tanya, you can do anything. And so I never think of you for anything. And I think that what happens is that, I tell this to my students, you can be an actor or you can be a star. And oftentimes being a star means people know you for a certain thing, and they know we want this, we want that person, or we want someone who is like that person. And you can get caught up in playing the same thing over and over again. It's sort of the commodification of the art. You do that. Oh, we need strong, so we need Viola Davis for that, or a Viola Davis type for that. And that sort of limits people. And so then you have actors who go, well, I'm not going to just be that, which means they turn down those opportunities to keep doing the same thing over and over again because they want the opportunity to have a variety of work under their belt.
You know, you bring up something really interesting. As you were talking, I was thinking, okay, if you took the whole cast of Friends as an example, you took the whole cast of, let's say, Seinfeld. Technically, all of those actors, in a way, have been typecast because we remember their iconic roles. But then you take the cast of, like, let's say, The Cosby Show, maybe The Jeffersons. Well, I'm trying to think of the other one. Martin Lawrence, for an example. they don't become typecast even if they're in iconic roles. Because for some reason, they... I don't know why that is.
But there's
do you have an opinion?
There's a different kind of typecasting that happens with that. For white actors, there's a bajillion of kind of roles. So it's like, you're going to stay in this lane because we know we can count on you to do this and this and this and this and this. And you open movies in this kind of role, boom. For black actors, they're not thought of as being able to open a movie, but they're thought of as you're a name. So now whenever there's a black actor of any age range, if it just says black, we're going to get the name ones. And that would always be something for me when I would go to an audition, it would be black. You'd see people from 18 to 80 for the role. It's like, we just want the name one that everybody knows. So it did afford you the opportunity to do different things, but it meant that some actors weren't getting an opportunity because it was like, well, it was written for an 18-year-old, but we can get Alfre Woodard. We're changing that. Because Alfre Woodard is a name.
I get that. Well, you appeared in 245 episodes of All My Children. How did you make the transition from soaps to television dramas and sitcoms?
That is a kind of harrowing story. I grew up watching All My Children from the time I was 7. And, you know, Pine Valley, I dreamed of Pine Valley all my life. So when I first got to New York, one of the first auditions I had after Mary Lou We Roll Along closed was for All My Children. And I just knew I was going to get it. I knew it. I knew I was going to get it so much that I had an opportunity to work at Actors Theater of Louisville, which was on my bucket list of places to play. I still haven't gotten to play it. And I turned it down because I knew I was going to get this role. And I was supposed to, I had to leave for Actors Theater of Louisville on Saturday. And my screen test was on Monday. Monday comes and they canceled the screen test because I didn't even know this existed until this moment. They had already had an offer out to Debbie Morgan for the role of Angie in All My Children. So I did not get the part. And I didn't have any job at all because I had turned down Actors Theater of Louisville too. So right at that time, they were bringing a lot of young, sort of the teen set onto soap operas. And I think I auditioned for General Hospital and Another World. And I ended up in the next year booking As the World Turns as Heather Dalton with Meg Ryan, Julianne Moore, Stephen Weber, Marissa Tomei. And I did that for a few years. And they were very harsh about enforcing the exclusivity of the contract when I was working there on CBS. So I booked 4 or 5 Cosbys, Miami Vices, and the show just wouldn't allow me to do them.
What, you know, that's what I was wondering, because when I was looking at your resume and I saw this stretch of time with All My Children, I'm like, did she get... You know, I was thinking, was that a contract situation to where you weren't really allowed to be on any other shows? So it sounds exactly what you said.
That's what they did to me on As the World Turns, and I eventually quit. I broke my contract because I was like, you're not using me. And there's all these other opportunities you're making me turn down. By the time I got All My Children, which is a sort of fabulous story, I was doing Jelly's Last Jam at the Taper in Los Angeles. And a girlfriend of mine was about to screen test for this new role on All My Children. And she mentioned it to me. And I was like, oh, My Children's got a new role. I didn't even audition for it. And they're already at the screen test. So I called my agent. I said, can you call them and see if they would, you know, bring me in? The brilliant Joan Dincheco, who cast everyone on All My Children, from Lucci to Jill Larson to everybody, you know, Judith Light. She remembered me from 15 years before and that audition for Angie, and she had them bring me straight forward to a test. And so I booked Livia.
Wow, that is incredible. I love the fact that casting directors have a pretty good memory.
They did then, because they would go and see everything.
And so here you are appearing in over 200 episodes. And so you ended that run in 2009. I know the show ended in 2011. Did you see that the end was coming?
Well, contractually, once again, that same sort of thing happened with other opportunities. So what happened with all my children is I stopped asking. If someone offered me a job, I would be like, here are my days off. You can shoot me on these days off because they're not going to say yes. And so what ended up happening is after a time, they too started saying, okay, well, we see you've worked your way around this. We do still have you under an exclusive contract. So if you want to do any other job besides this, you have to give us back $10,000 on your contract. And so I did that for a time. And then it was like, you know, the opportunities in nighttime television are so much more lucrative. I was like, okay, I quit that contract again. And then for the last sort of 4 years of my time on All My Children, I was just recurring and coming in as needed. I was no longer under contract.
Yeah, see, the thing that I look at in this situation is that you are such an experienced actress. Soaps, do you feel that soaps can dumb down your talent if you're there too long?
I don't think so. I think it is like you are training there. You know, you got to do 100 pages a day. You know, doing Sisters is like being on the soap opera again. Most nighttime TV shows, they shoot 26, 22 episodes in 9 months. Tyler Perry shoots 22 episodes in 9 days.
I know. And how many pages does he shoot on Sisters a day?
125 to 150.
Yeah, I've heard that, boy, he gets the job done because I know that in the beginning on some of the series that he does, like in like let's say season one, the budget is not that big for season one, and he literally has worked out. He knows how to take that tiny budget, get the most out of it, and in most cases, turns it into a hit.
That's soap opera training right there, because I went in there last season and I did 12 episodes in 4 days.
So Tyler's doing Sisters.
Tyler wasn't there. That was the first season that he had turned it over to someone who had assisted him for the last 10 years. So last season was somebody else. So I didn't work with him at all on it last season, but I did 12 episodes in 4 days.
Wow, you must have, that must really cause an actor to up their game working with Tyler.
I loved it because so much of working in television is just waiting. And then you're like eating. You're at the trough, stuffing your face all day, getting fatter and fatter. No, you don't even have time to eat on the Tyler Perry set. You don't have time to take photos with the people. You're like, they got people there to run your lines at you. You got your hair, your makeup, your costumes, and then you're on set and you're shooting. And then it's over. It's like being shot out of a cannon. I found the adrenaline rush thrilling.
Well, I've heard that he's able to even film some of his feature films in less than a
9 days.
month.
He does 9 day shoots on features too. When we were leaving Sisters, he had three movies features coming in and he was going to shoot 9 days each.
Does the
Well,
man
he's got a
sleep?
city. He's got a city. You know, they've got the they've got streets. It's like a lot, just like a Hollywood lot, like the 20th Century Fox lot or the MGM or the Warner Brothers lot. He's got that.
Yeah, he has built such an incredible empire. I love Tyler Perry. I mean, he's really setting the standard, but he never lets grass grow under his feet.
Not at all. And that mind, he's got to be juggling 20, 30 projects at a time.
Oh, I know. And I see for you've appeared in Gotham, Madam Secretary, Fear of the Walking Dead. 24 Scandal's probably has been probably one of my favorite dramas. You know, because if people watch Scandal long enough, yeah, that's pretty much how DC works.
Yeah, I love doing Scandal. That was so fun.
Yeah, that's a great cast. Now, you appeared in a short-lived series which I loved. And was so disappointed that it never came back, never even made a blip in Variety or the Hollywood Reporter. But you appeared in God Friended Me. I loved that show from the very first episode. I mean, you might as well grab Kleenex at every episode because, you know, tears are going to be running down your face towards the end anyway. But did that particular show get caught up in the midst of the pandemic, which is why it never came back?
Yeah, it was one of the pandemic cancellations. Yeah, I shot that literally the week before the lockdown.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love that show.
Yeah.
Well, then that brings me to the next question, because as an actor, how did you navigate through the pandemic as well as last year's actor's strike?
It was a good time for me. I know it wasn't for a lot of people, but for me, it was about like getting off of a treadmill and figuring out like, what are my values? I was working on Red Pill. I had just filmed that in the fall of 2019 from, you know, like 11 days. And so I was in the midst of the edit and I didn't know what I was doing. I'd never made a film before. And I had messed up every time I hired an editor. I had hired and fired 4 editors. And in the middle of the pandemic, I met this filmmaker, a brilliant filmmaker named Minji Kong. And she turns out she'd been living in America for like 20 years and she had just gone back to Korea. I looked at Korea. At that moment in time, only 500 people had died from COVID. I was like, it's safer for me over there. And so when she agreed to edit the film, I was like, I'm moving to Korea. And so I went to Korea and the government, you get off the plane, they stick you in a hotel for quarantine and you pay for it. And once you come out of quarantine, then you can be with people. So I stayed in South Korea for a couple of months and edited my first feature film. So that was this life-changing moment for me to get to build a world and to be the god of a world. That's really what a movie is. Like, I'm the god of this world and the people do what I say and they go there and you don't like it? Well, go make your own world.
What? Wow, so when you came back from Korea and just entered the world of mask and everything else, did you feel like going back?
Mask is very serious in Korea. Oh, no. You wearing a mask. Everybody has the same kind of mask. It's an N, whatever that N.
Yeah, the N95.
The N95. Like, people would probably stone you if you did not have your mask. And on the streets in South Korea, there are announcements like round the clock in 4 languages. You wear a mask for your neighbor. And so, yeah, you were wearing masks, but in the home where we were doing the editing, I could sit with my editor and we could just be together. But masking, I think I really loved my time in Korea, but I really began to appreciate the polarity of America because the uniformity that is required there is really quite severe. And I have a lot of artist friends there and I could see the way it's tough to be an artist in Korea because you're supposed to be a doctor or a lawyer or something like that, you know? So I could see the pressure on my genius artist friends that they're just not going to get any respect for that unless they became Bong Joon-ho, you know? Other than that, you're nothing. So I came back to America going, you know what? People hating each other and disagreeing, I think I prefer that.
Well, tell me about this award-winning film, Red Pill, that you directed and was released in 2021.
So I, going into both the 2016-2020 election, I just had a real sense of what was going to happen. And I remember for the 2016 election, it was just really clear to me who was going to win. And I just didn't know how anybody could not know that. And I live in New York, so people looked at me with 2 heads, like contempt. How could you know, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to have a political conversation with you, but people want to say that he's an idiot. I'm like, no, the man is not an idiot. He's not an idiot. I'm sorry, you don't get to be there and be an idiot. So even today, people, I was like, okay, you want to underestimate people, you can underestimate them all you want. It was clear to me how that was going to go. And it was terrifying to me that the people in my liberal enclave could not see it. Like, they were so certain. I went to sleep on election night. It was so clear to me how that was going.
And then you woke up the next morning going, I told you so.
You know what? I woke up the next morning and I was on the set of Madam Secretary. And the Teamsters were like handing out donuts. And they were happy. And everybody else was like depressed. And I was just like, there's no surprises here. And so when 2020 happened, I also had this really keen sense of what was going to happen. I didn't really want to go through the contempt anymore. And so I just thought, can I make a piece of art that really just reflects my perspective as a Black woman? I was really clear that not a lot of people were going to agree with my perspective, but there was no more conversations to have. I'd saved a little money. I'd asked some friends to help me. And I said, I'm just going to make this story. Yeah, I know nobody's going to get it. I remember when I handed out the scripts to friends, they were like, this is so ridiculous. This is so far-fetched. I was like, that's okay. I'm just going to take art. I'm going to make art out of what I'm feeling. And that's what I did. And it was one of the most empowering things I've ever done.
Well, like I said, it's an award-winning film. So a lot of people really liked it.
Yeah. I knew it would be much more successful outside of the U.S. rather than inside the U.S. because the U.S., just doesn't want to see that perspective.
Yeah, and was that perspective harder because you're Black?
I will say that one of the experiences of being born in this body, which is both Black and both female, is that there is, as a general rule, an inability for people to see expertise as coming from me. And so there's always a sense of being underestimated or devalued, even as an elected official of the union. There's just always that sense. And so, you know, Tyler Perry worked that to his advantage. I remember once I was at an opening and the conversation was going on. I just happened to be at the table of this conversation so that I was listening to a conversation. And one of his attorneys was there and he was talking about them doing their Lionsgate deal and how, you know, a 3-share is considered a lot. Like, the critically acclaimed shows that we see, a 3-share is what they get, but they get the critical acclaim and it's prestigious and awards and stuff like that. So a 3-share is a lot. An 8-share is miraculous. Very few shows ever get that. And a lot of times those shows that get that don't get the critical acclaim. They're just audience favorites. And so Lionsgate really just wanted a piece of the action. They didn't have any respect for him. And so they said that they said to them, well, you know, you're telling us that if we get a 3, you'll bring us back next year. And they said, well, if we get an 8, will you guarantee us 100 episodes in syndication? And Lionsgate thought that was so ridiculous that they said, sure. He knew his audience. Every one of those series, like there's like 20 plus of them, syndication, every single one.
That is incredible. You know, I remember, and you remember the days too, you know, in television, it was always Aaron Spelling this, Aaron Spelling that. Now it's Tyler Perry.
Yeah.
How times have changed.
Yeah, I did an Aaron Spelling series. I was the only series that I've ever been a contract player on, nighttime series, was an Aaron Spelling series called University Hospital, which they billed as Charlie's Angels in the Hospital, and it did 9 episodes and died.
Yeah, I don't see that working. Yeah, I don't see that working at all. And it's funny because even today, when they announce new series, they keep playing the same formula. It's either a doctor show, it's either going to be a law type show, is going to be either a detective police department or sometimes a fire department, which I find sometimes kind of boring. And so they always go with the same formula. I'm like, what happened to all of the funny sitcoms and, you know, and other sorts of things? But I guess a lot of that is now just on streaming. You either have to connect with Hulu or Netflix or Paramount.
And the algorithm telling them what to do. I mean, I was watching Golden Girls last night. What a great show.
That, oh, That will always be a great show. And but you have to tell me about this essay that you wrote. I am so interested about this, called "Why I Am Fed Up with Performative Activism from Black and White Theater Makers." What is that about?
Well, when the pandemic happened, nobody's working. The theater shuts down. And some group of artists got together and decided that this was their moment to tell the establishment in the American theater how terrible they had been to them. And so there were various enclaves of this, each drafting different letters. And so I was contacted from various people with drafts of the letter. Would I sign on? It was going to be anonymous. And I just was like, I can't sign on because this is not my experience. And so when the letter was published, it was called We See You White American Theater. That was the organization. And they published this letter, and it was signed by well over a million people. So it really resonated with a lot of people. There were no the writers of the letter were anonymous. So you don't know who they are. And they didn't name anybody. They just were talked about these terrible things that had happened to them here and there and there, and it was like all of this general complaining. And I just was watching this, and then people were jumping forward to say, well, I never did this, and I was this. And so it was like, oh, okay, so you think because your name wasn't in there that it couldn't possibly be you, and you were too afraid to tell who you're talking about because you don't want to lose out on opportunities. And so I just felt compelled to write this 26-page essay where I said, if you're going to call somebody out, this is how you do it. You have to own who you are. You have to name who you're doing, or they don't know that it's them. And that's what I did. And I said, if people did this to you, it's because you accepted it because there was something you wanted. So they didn't do it to you. You agreed. You wanted the award. You wanted the opportunity. I said, if I'm in a room and that the kind of things you're describing are happening, I bring it up, it gets addressed, or I leave the room. And people have the right to want to have an all-white whatever. They have a right to want it. You don't have to give it to them. But if you gave it to them, you were complicit. But you can't tell people what they want. People can want things that aren't good or aren't fair or aren't right. They can want them. You can't police people's desire, but you don't have to go along with that desire.
Well, you nailed it. You nailed it. I mean, and because the acting world, and you know this firsthand, how many people have taken a role, put up with so much crap, only because they didn't want it to hurt their career and allowed other people to walk all over them.
Yeah, people do it all the time.
Wow, what? I love the industry, but there are areas that need to be addressed and need to be improved. But what did you do during the actor's strike?
What did I do during the actor strike? I'm trying to remember. Well, I will say that because acting is so precarious, and it's always been, and I've been fortunate to really work a lot and consistently. But I was when Coca-Cola had a campaign called Coke and a Smile, I was the smile. And I remember the audition for that. And I remember sitting in this room, and there was a whole bunch of ad agency people going, man, but her nose and her this and her that. And so I was like 14. And so from a very early age, I really understood that my entire career was at the whim of people who had preferences and dislikes, and that my talent really never had any meaning. And so I just never could put all my eggs in the basket of a career. I was like, I have to make a life for myself, and I have to make a life that I want to live. And so when I was studying Meisner with William Esper, I was pregnant with my first child, doing the Meisner, birthed the child, doing the repetition and all that with my baby in a thing. And at the end of the first year, Bill said to me, don't have any more kids, because you have to take time off of your life to do that. And all of the actors you're coming up with right now, they're going to surpass you. They're going to have opportunities that you aren't going to have. And so don't do this. Well, I didn't do what he said, and I had four kids. And I don't have any regrets, and I don't feel like I missed out on opportunities. I feel like the jobs that were mine to have, I did. And yes, all of those other actresses, they did surpass me. Many of them became very wealthy and famous and superstars, but many of them didn't have children or had to get surrogate children or whatever. I've had the privilege of birthing four children at home. I've had a life, and that has always been my priority. So one of my life priorities is I'd like to visit every country of the world. And there's like, some people say 195, some people say 222, whatever that is. I have done only 81.
I had a late friend of mine when he passed, he was 93. I believe he only missed 3 or 4. And what was so funny, he emailed me one day and he said, hey, guess what? I got into Iran. And I went, how and why? And he goes, well, I can't tell you how because I don't want anybody to know, but I got in, so it's off my list.
Yes, it's on my list to get into. It is on my list as well. Don't know when or how, but it's on my list because I want to visit everywhere. So I did a lot of traveling. We also did Women of the Movement down in Mississippi for 3 months during the pandemic.
Really?
Yeah.
Was that tough, being on set, getting tested every day, wearing the mask, and then taking it off for the role?
It was kind of crazy because when you got there, you couldn't eat with other people. All meals had to be individually packaged. You could never be with other people. So everybody had their own car and they had to drive themselves to set. No vans. And then some of the actors were just like, they were just going to have a revolution. And they were like, we got to have a bar. Or we going to go out to a bar and get COVID. And so after about 6 weeks of that, they kind of loosened it up a little bit. But for that first 6 weeks, you were never with another human being except when you were filming a scene.
Wow. Was that tough, not be able to practice lines before a scene?
It was tough, and it's still tough because so much of being an actor is the camaraderie and the community. And you go to an audition and you run into somebody and then you go have tea or talk, and you know, you get jobs because someone goes, oh, you know, I was up for that and I'm not available. Let me tell them and tell them about you. Now we only see each other at memorials. You know?
Now, because you're so experienced, are you still required to do self-tapes, or they just say, hey, no, we want Tanya?
I absolutely am required to do self-tapes. And so I sort of consider myself retired, because I find them humiliating. I mean, I've got to be the actor, I've got to be the cameraman, I've got to be the lighting designer, I've got to find a reader, then I've got to edit it all, so I've got to decide what are the best takes. When am I going to be an actor? And so I still do them every now and then. Fortunately, you know, Sisters was an offer, but I just did an episode of a show that's being billed as David Schwimmer's return to television, Goosebumps. I play his buddy on that, but I had to do a self-tape for that.
Wow. You know, it's so funny because every time I ask that question, every actor says something different. Some of them love it because, like, hey, I could take 10 takes and pick out the best one. Others are like, no, I want to walk into a room, have people stare at me, and then I will do it. You know, so everybody's different on what they want. And of course, if they get a call back, the callbacks are usually by Zoom. So.
At by Zoom. I know. And where's the eyeline? Is that my eyeline or is this my eyeline? And woo, it's a lot. It's a lot. And I miss people. I think I became an actress because I like the community. I like the collaboration. And you know, I when I'm working with young people now, they don't know how to be with humans. They actually don't know how to act with another human. For someone to actually look at them and notice something and respond over them, that is like, whoa, you're pushing buttons. You're going to traumatize them with that. Yeah.
Well, see, I was raised to where you look people in the eye, you shake their hand with a firm handshake, you open the door for a woman, I was taught all of those things, and I think the devil in the midst of our society is probably Apple. Now they're all causing us to look down at a screen that is not alive. And I think we need people like Stella Adler back to encourage everyone to live the life that is around you and lift your head and look and experience and feel and soak that in.
Organic life, which is like all microplastic now, but you know, my manager's husband has the new Apple glasses, and they bill it as you get to have multiple layers of reality. So you're seeing the world, but the world you're seeing is a recording of the world. But the transmission is so fast that you can play ping pong with the recording because it's showing you the world so quickly that your reflexes start to adjust. Like you said, there's a delay here, but that delay is so fast that you can play live with someone who is in a room, but you're in the headset looking at a recording of them in the room, and then you can have all your screens there. And she was saying how her husband loves it because he can see her and the kids, and he feels like he's in the room with them. And she's like, honey, we don't feel like you're in the room with us. But I guess if you have a whole house full of people with the headsets on, everybody will be, it's the Matrix.
That's the end of mankind. That's exactly what it, now for you, Tanya, what upcoming projects do you have coming up that you can talk about?
Well, I'm on Sister still. I think I've got about eight more episodes left, and hopefully she'll come back for the next season. As I said, I'm on Goosebumps. That's supposed to be a recur. We'll see. And I have a film, a feature film that I directed and produced called Game Night that will hopefully be released sometime this year. And I'm in the process of working with a streamer to possibly write and direct another thriller that I hope that I will make it through all the stages. You know, there's like a this many stages, and do they approve that stage? And do they approve that stage? And I'm hoping I'm gonna make the race through to all the stages, and it will be a finished film that will be online for people to watch.
And so everyone can connect with you at tanyapinkins.com.
Yes.
And also too, you have a book of Red Pill, correct?
Red Pill Unmasked, which is both an ebook and an audiobook you can hear on Audible and Barnes and Noble. And I also wrote a sort of self-help book that was published by Hyperion in 2006 called Get Over Yourself: How to Drop the Drama and Claim the Life You Deserve. And then a podcast that there's about 200 and some episodes called You Can't Say That, the show where you can on the Broadway Podcast Network.
Oh, I love that. I'm going to have to check that out myself. It has been an absolute enjoyable time with you today.
Well, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure to speak with you too, Ward.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you're not a fan of Tanya Pinkins now, you're going to be. So head over to tanyapinkins.com, follow her on all the socials, check out Sisters on BET. She has so much going on. This is one of the most experienced seasoned actors you will ever see. She is an absolute talent, multi-talented. So, Tanya, I know that we're expecting even more great things from you in the future, and we can't wait. So you're gonna have to come back and share all that with us.
Thank you. Would love to.
You're very welcome. And ladies and gentlemen, you can catch all of the replays of our interviews with the top film directors and producers, as well as screenwriters and actors. More on Bond on Cinema. We're also available on YouTube, as well as a dozen audio platforms as well. I want to thank you for watching and listening, And as for me, I'll either see you at the movies or from the red carpet.